Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. I am your storytelling host, Fanny Crawford, and
I am Stasi Okowski, the other storytelling host.
We are your storytelling hosts. We're glad to be with you this morning. It is Monday, June 29th, almost the end of the month.
Yes.
Halfway, well, technically, in my head, halfway through the summer, because I'm always ahead of myself.
Yeah, you're a little early on that, but it's okay.
It comes so fast, the end of summer, and I still don't have my green beans planted.
Well,
but I'm happy to be here talking to you guys on the radio.
Yes, it's so good to be someplace.
It's good to be indoors for short periods of time. Today, our theme on the radio is nuts and berries, nuts and berries, and we have some stories lined up for you.
Yes.
We want to thank Andy Offutt Irwin for the introduction to our show this morning. You were listening to his original composition, Tarry Here. Thanks to Andy for giving us permission to use that each week.
He's a very generous man.
He is.
Generous with his laughter, too.
Fortunately for us.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Shall I make any announcements?
I was just going to say, do you have any announcements, Stas?
Well, I'm just going to promote Speak Story Series. If you want to get any information and details about this, go to speakstoryseries.com and on the website, and you can find out all the details. But on July 14th, which will be 2 weeks from tomorrow, I believe, Tom Lee from Connecticut will be appearing via Zoom virtual storytelling for the Speak Story Series. And I just want to push the idea that the Speak Story Series has been very successful with their virtual performances. In May, Kevin Kling, and in early June, Laura Packer, and now July 14th with Tom Lee. We've had excellent attendance at those, and the fans have been very loyal to the Speak Story Series, and which I think is true of a number of places around the country. People love storytelling, and they love storytellers, and it's so nice that people have kind of flocked to the programs that are being presented. Some for pay, of course, people that are storytellers and do it to make a living, need to have somebody pay them and so they can eat. And some for free. So that's great. There's some, I have one coming up July 8th, myself, for the Washington County Libraries, Washington County, Maryland Libraries.
Woo!
And today I'll find out whether I'm going to be allowed to tell a certain tale, which has caused some consternation, and at first I was very upset about it and thought, that's silly. Why would anybody worry about that, a little children's tale? However, after thinking, just much like happens with most things that irritate me or upset me or interest me, once I settle down and I can relax a little bit, then I start things come into focus, and I say, oh yeah, right. Some people might be upset by that. So I'm going to get the word this afternoon. Also, I want to say that it was a pleasure to be with you on Saturday virtually, and to hear your wonderful story about those two, Jep and Dank, right? And I just like hearing about them because it was driving me crazy about their adventures. And when you start to describe them, it gives me shivers. It's like, whoa. anyway, we both were pleased to be with Sheila Arnold, a presentation Saturday where she had 14 different storytellers. And I was able to relate to my wife and to some friends last night on a video call that it was, for me, it was just like being at Jonesboro. Because I sat in my kitchen waiting for my turn to go on stage in my kitchen. And I started at about 1:45 in the afternoon. And I didn't stop until about 6:15.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful because I was comfortable. I was relaxed. And I was just immersed in stories. Sheila was marvelous.
She was amazing.
And she is so positive.
And she told three stories of her own, apparently, yes, extemporaneously.
Right.
Deciding which ones to tell based on who told what beforehand.
Right.
Yeah. She was
and really filled in incredibly for someone who I guess there might have been 15 storytellers. One of the storytellers
was missing, yeah.
Was missing. And she just smiled and said, well, I guess better tell a story, and kept going. And I was have a mild panic when I'm performing and someone says, you're performing at 5:15. I do not expect someone to say at 4:59, oh, hey, we had a change. You're on.
Yeah.
But that was, I was thinking, oh, no, hope she doesn't say you're up here, because I always need a few minutes ahead of time to panic and kind of settle myself now.
So. It was fun, though. That's my overwhelming sense of the afternoon.
It was a long
period of time to be online. And, of course, most people who were in the audience were not on there the whole time.
Right. But
we had a lot of people listening, and it was just so much fun. I really enjoyed myself.
Well, the counter in the upper corner on the screen at one time went to 96 on my screen.
Really?
Yes. And for a long time, it was in the 80s. And when we took the actual 15-minute bathroom break, I guess I can say that on air, it was amazing we didn't lose many people.
No.
The number went down as far as people being on, but then it went right back up when we started again. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was a great experience. And anyone who hasn't heard Sheila Arnold, or even if you have, you can look for her on the web, and she has an amazing number of things coming up. When she showed the things roster coming up on the screen, I got tired. So,
and give me a sound check. Because I just turned my timer on.
Oh, a sound check.
I don't
mean
a sound check. I mean a time check.
Time check.
Sound, time, they're all the same.
I had four, 6 minutes, actually.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Gabbing.
We're good.
Great.
That's what we're supposed to do. That's why we make the big bucks, Stosh, because
we're good gabbers. Sometimes I realize that, and I forget that we're, paid so well. Okay. I mean, not many people would realize that two people blabbing on the radio get paid what we do.
You
can't even count it.
Let's not belabor the point.
Okay. All right. So, how about Are you going to start, or?
I can start unless you have more stories than me.
Well,
I only have one. So if you have more than one, okay, you should start.
Well, okay. yes. And as we talked about preparing this program, my part of the program is going to be about being out in the wilderness and, you know, where you might find people searching for berries and nuts and stuff like that. But the fruit and nuts kind of people, or fruit and nuts that I'm going to talk about, have to do with the United States Army. As a child, I'm the baby of the family. I'm the third boy. My sister was the oldest in the family. And it's pretty incredible that I never, ever got to go camping. My mother and father had a three-strike rule. Whatever my two brothers did wrong, I didn't get to even try. And they both messed up going on overnight camping. And so my first experience of being out in the woods and overnight camp was in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, in 1959. And part of basic training for the United States Army was to go out on bivouac and to live out of a tent for 7 days. And when you weren't in your tent, which was only at night, you were working and doing things and learning to be a good soldier in many ways. The very first, we marched 10 miles to our bivouac area. And so the very first day wasn't too bad. We didn't have too much to do except march and set up our tent and things. But because of a terrible storm just a couple days later, I believe it was when we started on Monday, I believe it was on Wednesday, a storm came in. It was a hurricane hitting that area. And we were apprised that if it came close enough to us, we would have to pack up our stuff and go back to what they called lovingly home, which were the barracks at the fort. And that storm gave me a chance to make a connection with the man from Alabama, Norman P. Simmons. And he became one of my best friends ever. I haven't seen Norman since 1962, when I left Germany. We were stationed together for 3 years in the same places. But an interesting thing happened that I thought little of, and he placed great emphasis on it because of his life practices and belief. We were in our tent. It was already raining, pouring down. And luckily, Norman had lots of experience. We were the same age, but he was a hunter, had camped for weeks in the woods back home, sometimes spent a month out in the wild with some of his buddies during the summertime. He was fortunate he didn't have to work on a farm or something like that, so he could get away from his family and do things, and he was encouraged to do that. When we set up our tent, he used some extra measures to make sure that the rain was not going to flood us out. There were a number of tent mates who spent the night with pieces of the tent wrapped around them and over them because their tent blew down from the wind storm. Our tent held up very well. But the important thing about this short story is that at about as soon as it got dark, I noticed Norman was fretting about something. And once it got dark, we were finished for the day as far as working, and we were told we could just do whatever we want as far as activities, but to stay in our tents, and we'd be called in the morning to begin at Reveille. Well, I noticed Norman seemed to be upset about something, and all of a sudden, he didn't cry, but he seemed so sad. And I thought, I thought he must be having a bad memory. And I said to him, I said, Norman, what's wrong? And when I was in the Army, everybody called me Ski because of my last name, my Polish name. And he said, Ski, for the first time in my life since I learned to read, I'm not going to be able to read my Bible before I go to sleep. And we had no flashlights, and we had no matches, and, anything like that. We were forbidden to bring any matches or things. Some guys had snuck lighters. They had, I guess, magic lighters, like electric kind of things, battery operated. But and I didn't say anything for a while, but then I thought, and you know me, so you know I'm not an overly religious person. I thought, this is terrible. This boy is 18 years old. He reads the Bible every night before he goes to bed. And so, without saying anything to Norman, I put on my boots and grabbed my poncho, put it on, and went out of our tent. And I went from tent to tent to everybody who was close to us. The next day, there were rumors that I had lost my mind because I was knocking on tents and getting people's attention, some of whom were already asleep, looking for a flashlight. And all I said each time I asked or talked to somebody, other than the ones who said, get the H out of here, and some other things, I said, I have an emergency in the tent. We need to be able to see something. Can you help me? And finally, I guess after about 8 or 9 tents and quite a bit of water running down my neck. And anyway, I got back to the tent with a small flashlight. And Norman was worried about me. He thought perhaps I had had a brain fuse or something. That's what he called it. I never heard of a brain fuse, lots of other things. And I said, no, I just had to do something for a friend. And I gave him the flashlight. Well, I don't think I've ever been more kindly thought of and thanked in my whole life. I've never read the Bible before going to bed, but Norman was able to read the Bible, and he told me the next morning he had the best sleep he'd had in years because I had been able to solve his problem and dilemma. And from that day on, there was almost nothing I needed that I couldn't ask Norman's help with. And we were together in basic training in El Paso, Texas for 10 months as in the same outfit, then in Germany for almost 2 years. And he was always such a great friend. And I hope he's still going strong. He had lots of positive, very good activities he could do. He was a great athlete. He was smart, good soldier. And he had, he took a lot of kidding about his name, because at that time there was a song about a guy named Norman. And it, you know, it was kind of, I don't remember the lyrics, but it was kind of a drippy song, and it was very popular. And it was, you know, anytime he turned a corner in the barracks or someplace else, people would sing Norman to him. And he just disliked that song. He wouldn't say he hated it, because that was a word he said he couldn't use. But he really disliked it. And again, it was good humored teasing, you know, gentle. Not, you know, it was just because it was kind of a song by a girl. And she was singing about the guy that she loved. And it was a sort of country song. So anyway, the next morning when we got up, we were being hustled to pack up and everything. And we got to do something that we became kind of famous for around Fort Jackson for a while. Our company commander decided that we were not going to get in trucks and go back to our base, because he wanted us to march the 10 miles in the hurricane winds to show what kind of, he had a number of expressions for it, but I get to show what kind of brave young men we were. Most of us were somewhere between the ages of 17 and 20. We didn't have any old guys in our company. And so we did the 10-mile march. I don't think I've ever been that wet in my whole life. Ponchos seemed to be useless because of the wind. We had full gear plus our rifles, and we did the 10-mile march. And because we did it so well, he gave us that the rest of the day and the next day off, which that was like Christmas. So we didn't see any nuts and berries, but I think we were nuts for doing it. And then it became such a mark of, you know, of pride and an honor. And we became very boastful about it. I heard people tell about our company in Texas and in Germany. There was this story going around about C Company and how tough we were. And anyway, I doubt that they're still telling that, because there's lots of things go on that are more important than walking 10 miles in a hurricane. But it turned out after the fact, it was fun. and none of my muscles ache anymore.
Great story. Well, you should get in touch with Norman.
I did for a while after we were out of the Army, but we both went, I went to college right after the Army and got into a different, I guess, mindset about things. And we lost touch after a while.
Yeah.
And that was true of lots of things, lots of people from the Army, you know. We felt close there, and because we had different, entirely different lives. There was almost nothing Norman did that I could relate to. Mm-hmm. I mean, he and one of his best friends went to their prom. Are you ready?
Yeah.
With a wagon and horses. They picked up their dates for the prom. They happened to date two sisters. And I don't know if they were twins, but it sounded like they must have been. And they drove a horse and buggy to their home and picked them up and then went to the school prom. And I thought I would never hear anything stranger than that in my life, except I met another guy whose last name was Eisenhower, and we called him Ike. And he told us stories about camping all summer from the last day of school until the day before school began again with his friends, a couple of them. They camped out in the forest and in one of the, well, they called it a mountain, but he said it really was just about a big hill. And he took his girlfriend to the prom on horses. She had her own horse. He lived on a ranch in Texas, and they went to the prom, and he had pictures of it, and it was just incredible to see this beautiful cowgirl and riding to the prom, and she did not wear a gown. She had a beautiful Western-style dress on, I guess, but he had lots of pictures. So I've never forgotten those two guys, you know? So it was pretty awesome.
You met some interesting people. Definitely broadened your horizons as a
I did. I met people all the way from, you know, at the level of Rhodes Scholar or genius down to someone who couldn't read or write. A boy who was in the basic with us who couldn't read or write and had gotten into the Army, and I don't know how he managed to do that, but shortly after basic training, he had to leave the Army because they discovered that he couldn't read or write, and he was, I don't know what you call it, when he wasn't kicked out so much as he was relieved of his requirements that he had signed up for. And when he was asked by a couple of us who found out that he was going to be leaving, he said, "I just watched the other guys in front of me when they were signing their papers, and I just scribbled something on a line because I couldn't read any of theirs and didn't make any sense to me, so nobody said anything to him." And he managed to stay in the Army for a few months. He knew enough to be able to say to somebody, "You know what? I don't seem to be able to see my name on there, and I thought I had guard duty coming up." And some, you know, and of course, his name was always on his uniform. They had printed on our uniforms, you know, on patches. And guy would look and say, "No, your name's not up there." He said, "Oh, okay, well, maybe next time." And he used a number of ploys like that to get around not being able to read, because guard duty was our responsibility. And you had to check on the bulletin board and see if your name was up for the next day. And
boy.
Yeah, and he was a phenomenal soldier. It's a shame that he, I don't know if he ever went back in the Army or anything, but he was one of the best rifle shots I've ever heard of in my life. Country boy. Mm-hmm. That he and Norman, a couple others who were used to carrying a rifle from the time they were six or seven to go, you know, squirrel hunting and things like that. And they kind of made fun of the way that the Army was teaching us to shoot a rifle. Mm-hmm. They kind of pretended to do what the sergeant said and just shot it their own way. And there were those two, Norman and we called him Mr. Bowles. That was his last name. And they both qualified at the highest you can with a rifle, you know, mm-hmm. top marksman and all that stuff. Anyway, I'm talking too much. You're not going to get a chance to tell your story.
These are great stories. Wonderful stories. This is a side of you I have not seen before, even though I've known you for years now. I never heard you be so taken or so astonished at people's use of horses.
Well,
to go to a prom. I'll admit, I've never met anybody who went to their prom on horseback or in a horse and cart. But still.
Well, being in the Army, you know, when I went in, I thought I was going to stay and become a career soldier. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't get a job right out of high school, weighed 110 pounds. You know, no, any job that required muscle or strength I couldn't get because I was small, and I figured the Army would be a good place to have a career. But once I got in, I found out that I was not good at taking orders from people who I thought didn't know what they were talking about. And you know me well.
You found out that you were the perfect candidate to be a college student.
I found out that there were 1,095 days in a 3-year enlistment, unless there was a leap year, which would make it 1,096 days. And I found that out by counting shortly after basic training. I got a calendar and I did the math, and I counted down the days until I would leave. And wow. After I left and started in college, I realized that those 3 years, I probably learned more in those 3 years about growing up and about life and about doing things that were worthwhile than mm-hmm. any years either before or after. I often say they were the best 3 years of my life.
Wow.
You know, I just was not good. I was not good at taking orders.
And we're glad you weren't.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't be the Sash that is so beloved today. Oh.
Then I were, and I might not even be alive because I was out of the Army and in college when Vietnam started. There were guys that I knew who went to Vietnam and never came home. Mm-hmm. And I never, sometimes when I look back at my life, I've been around a long time. I think making the decision at 17 to go in the Army, begging my father to sign papers and doing that. All of my friends thought I had lost my mind, because things were great at home. I played soccer. I played softball. I had fun. I was engaged to my sweetheart and all that. And I gave all that up, and they just couldn't understand it. But it really made a difference in my life.
Good stories, all of them. I love it.
I should tell
our listeners, you're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We're broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Diokowski.
We're glad you're here with us listening to stories. Do you have any other announcements you want to make, Stosh?
I don't know if anything coming up so much. Okay. I really don't. I'm hoping to hear soon about stories in the round.
I am too. And Sheila Arnold was a great inspiration to me with her managing that family storytelling festival yesterday that we were both part of. She really has given me hope.
She's marvelous. She never lost a beat, and that beautiful smile of hers.
And she was there for the entire 4 hours. I mean, she might have taken a 3-minute break that we didn't see, but she was present.
I'm telling you, she was, and she managed to keep her head above water constantly. As far as any of the, there were a few times when things could have gone bad, yeah, as far as technology and things, and she could just fix it right away and smiled, and her laugh is wonderful. I hope she invites us to do something again.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, well then I'm going to tell a story.
Okay.
And then I think we will have time for another story from you after that, if you're willing.
Well, who knows?
All right. So this is my nuts and berries story. In the beginning was the blueberry. Plump and juicy, they showed up in pancakes that my dad made for breakfast on Saturday or Sunday mornings. The rest of the week, we ate bowls of hot cereal for breakfast. Oatmeal, kasha, also called buckwheat groats, or Wheatina that my mother cooked while I got dressed to go to daycare or to school when I was older. Daddy left for work early each morning before I was awake because he was a cook at Lankenau Hospital in West Philly. But on the weekends, he was home and could make pancakes for us. One memorable day, this was before my little brother was born. I must have been about 3 years old. He took me to work with him to Lankenau Hospital kitchen, just the two of us there in that big, shiny silver room with gleaming white tile floors, shiny silver walls, enormous double door floor to ceiling refrigerators, and a silver stool that I sat on at a long silver work table to eat fresh made tapioca pudding in a clear glass dish with fluted edges. And tucked into the tapioca pudding, there were layers of whole blueberries that I could see through the glass. The shiny metal gleaming all around me was stainless steel, of course, but it looked like silver to me. And I felt very small in that enormous room, sitting on the high stool underneath these enormous pots hanging from hooks above me. That tapioca, my favorite dessert, of course, tapioca, was still warm from cooking, and I never had it with berries before. This must be how princesses feel every day. The start of every summer, from the time I was 7 years old, and my little brother was, I guess he was two by then. So that's when I began my personal pilgrimage to children's summer camp outside of Horsham, PA, near Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, if you know the Philadelphia suburbs. It was a Quaker-run camp, a settlement house spinoff. There weren't many Quaker children there. There were some. But that experience was intended to give urban kids like me a summer adventure. And that first year, the nature counselor, Kit, took us on hikes almost every day through woods and meadows. I came down with my first annual case of poison ivy. I learned a dozen different birds by song and sight. And I had a new heretofore undiscovered treasure trove of Bible stories. Kit, the nature counselor, usually chose our resting spots for our hikes near a thicket of raspberry or blackberry bushes, at least till we had cleaned out her wild pantry. That was a lovely education in wild berries. And my first time at camp was just a regular two-week camp session. But after that, I was never there for less than a month. And within 2 years, I was only coming home in time to go camping with the family. And we were a camping family. We'd load up our old rattle trap car, well, a series of cars over the years from an almost antique 1941 or so, two-door dusty green battered Plymouth sedan, then a two-tone pink and white Chevy with tail fins, and eventually a green Plymouth station wagon that seemed to last forever, way into my teen years. Those cars, always used cars and predisposed to odd coughing and jittery fits, always riding low to the ground, loaded down with us kids riding in the back with coolers, army blankets, quilts, and duffel bags in the back seat. And our huge green army issue canvas tent, the one with 6 foot collapsible metal poles that were too heavy for me to lift alone, wrapped up in a green canvas tarp on the roof of the car. When Mom and Dad set up the tent at a campsite, there were plenty of room inside that tent for all four of us to stand fully upright, sleep on wood and canvas folding army cots, and store our duffel bags, extra blankets, and quilts inside. We moved to a different state park every other night, generally about a half day's drive on two-lane roads. We were headed for Portville, Olean, Jamestown, and Buffalo, New York to visit my dad's sisters and brothers, our aunts and uncles, and our cousins. And on the way to each campsite, we'd stop at farm stands for fresh produce, tomatoes and squash for dinner, plums, nectarines, and apples for eating in the car, and blueberries and black raspberries for our pancake breakfasts that Daddy cooked on the Coleman stove or over a campfire every morning. They were the best pancakes ever, smothered in butter. Sometimes we had Canadian bacon on the side, better even than the pancakes that Daddy made at home on weekends. Now in Western New York, between Portville and Jamestown, New York, lies Allegheny State Park with Red House Lake, beautiful campsites and log cabins, and a massive log, stone, and glass lodge built by teams of local workers employed during the Great Depression by President Franklin Roosevelt's Work Progress Administration. Allegheny was our favorite camping site, and since it was close to Daddy's childhood home and near his sisters and their families, we were usually there for a week at a time. It was near there, at Allegheny, that he took me fishing for the first time with a bamboo pole and newly dug worms for bait. We didn't catch anything, but that was fine with me. Mostly we talked about the trees and the plants around us and what it was like for him fishing with his dad years and years back. Now, with hindsight, I think watching me fishing there by the creek reminded him that his dad had been completely flummoxed that Daddy and his younger brother, my Uncle John, would bring books with them on their fishing expeditions, and they were happy to sit in the shade and just read, oblivious to whether there was anything to carry home for dinner. My dad talked about that much, much later. We did find some wild raspberries that day to munch on, and I think they were probably the last berries of the season. Just a few miles away from Red House Lake and the state park at Allegheny was the headquarters of the Seneca Nation, the Haudenosaunee, one of the peoples of the six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, an alliance and a governing body that served as an early model for our U.S. Constitution. Daddy would talk about the history of the Seneca every summer as we drove across Seneca land and visited the town of Salamanca, where modern-day Native Americans live side by side with European and African Americans. But most interesting to me were the special events sponsored by the Seneca themselves, with dancers in traditional costumes, tables full of beadwork, clothing, wood and leather drums, flutes for sale to tourists like us. That's where I first learned about pemmican, the traditional Indian travel food made of dried meat and berries ground together in a kind of a paste that could keep for days to sustain hunters or anybody else carrying pemmican on the trail. I learned of the Seneca orchards, apples, peaches, and plums, and that the Iroquois were exemplary orchardists among Native Americans. I read about the Iroquoian Civil War and the shattering of the Iroquois Confederacy as a result of the American Revolution, when the British recruited the Seneca, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, and Mohawk nations as allies, putting them at odds with their cousins, the Oneidas and the Tuscaroras, who sided with the rebels in the Revolution. During the summer and fall of 1779, under the command of George Washington, Generals John Sullivan and James Clinton burned to the ground 40 Iroquois settlements with their crops, food stores, and 1,500 orchard trees. More than 5,000 Haudenosaunee men, women, and children fled north to Ontario and Canada, surviving on winter roots and berries, the records said, as they sought food and shelter from the British. Thousands more died of starvation and disease during the harshest winter in the records of the colonial period. Iroquois territory from New York to Pennsylvania to Ohio was turned over to white settlers, with just a few isolated pockets of land ceded to the devastated Iroquois survivors who remained below the Canadian border in the treaties that ended official hostilities. There are so many berry stories that I could share with you. The 6-inch trout that I caught and ate for dinner with the berries that I picked along a creek in the high Rocky Mountains. My mother's idea of a quick and easy summer lunch of sour cream and strawberries many a day in my school days. My dad's cousin Lorna's amazing blueberry pies at every family reunion in Olean, New York. Picking elderberries and feeding them to the chickens in Aunt Thelma's yard. Buying raspberries from Mr. Bloyer at the Boonesboro auction and complaining to him that they molded over before I could eat them, till he explained, "Darling, you can't leave them on top of the refrigerator for 24 hours. Buying blueberries by the 20-pound box from a Mennonite farmer on the Hagerstown Square. And these days, my frequent dinners of blueberry apple smoothies. But I'm making myself hungry. I hear berries calling me from the kitchen." You're back.
Yes. You know, doing this Zoom thing, every once in a while, since I'm using an iPad, I guess it would be the same if I had a computer, but something will pop up on my screen. I get notifications from the New York Times and different places. And just as you were finishing, I got a notice about the Supreme Court made some kind of announcement, and I couldn't find the mute button to turn it back to turn my voice back on. Anyway, I finally did.
You were reading about the Supreme Court when you could have been listening to my story.
No, I wasn't at all. I was about to touch the mute button to unmute myself.
Yes.
Just as you were finishing. But the Supreme Court notification was written across my across my screen, and I couldn't tell where the mute button was.
So I had distracted, distracted by the Chief Justice.
Yeah, I'm often distracted by the Chief Justice. You know, there's so much going on in this country now that's I seldom. I don't post, what do you call those things? Things that cause people's ire to go up. What were you going to say?
Controversial.
Yeah, I try not to. A few years ago, I posted a couple of things during a week's time and was blasted by friends, relatives, and stuff like that about my political leanings. And I actually lost some friends, some relatives who just cut me out of, being connected with them. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought, wow, that's strange. It's sort of childish. thinking again, about the Army, I remember thinking, I lived with African Americans in basic training in the same room, slept, you know, in the same room with African Americans. I had something I'd never even, I don't think I'd ever talked to an African American person in my entire life, except for a boy I met playing baseball in Patterson Park in a pickup game, a boy named Dennis, who was one of the best ball players I ever saw in my life. And I actually tried to get him onto our team. But when I mentioned it to the manager of our team that was based out of a church in Baltimore, he explained to me that Dennis couldn't play on our team because he didn't belong to the same parish. And when I mentioned to him I didn't belong to that parish either, he explained to me that I was too young to understand certain rules. And I was in basic training with people who had wildly different ideas about everything I knew, and yet we got along fine. You know, I didn't feel hated or disliked, or and maybe I was insignificant enough not to waste time on, but I never have felt like that. I met people from different cultures, and never experienced this kind of thing that's been going on for the last 3.5 years about people being so divided and actually saying so many hateful things, you know, about groups and people. And so anyway, I recently posted a couple of things, and I expect the walls to come tumbling down again. Yeah. But I did get a surprise from one of the people I coached with, who was a dear friend, and I still consider him a dear friend, but we have extreme opposite views on some political things. Not political, actually life things, different kind of cultures being together and stuff. And he actually wrote and said, this was a good idea. And, you know, so I was pleased. I thought maybe the world's changing, you know. Anyway, that's my subtle sideways comment about the political atmosphere.
Maybe we should have a story session, a program on social media.
Oh, wow. That would be good. It's interesting. Social media is a wonderful thing. You know, I connected with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, many of whom were my students. Over the years, you know, from my 4 years of teaching, I have students that I have been contacted and seen things from students all the way back to the late 60s when I began teaching, up to the 2000s when I stopped teaching. And just this morning I read a nice post from a student that was on my track team and in my classroom, a young lady from Reisterstown, Maryland, who actually now I think lives in California. And she posted a thing about going to the store and seeing a baby in a car on a parking lot on a hot day. Mm-hmm. And immediately went to the store in this shopping center, to a big store, a Walmart, and there was a man who was, she thought, was a guard of some kind, and told him. He immediately used his phone to call 911, and in a matter of minutes, a fire truck and a police car showed up, and they opened that car and took the baby out. And the baby wound up going in the ambulance. because of the heat, and I was amazed, to read that story this morning, and later today I'm hoping to get an answer back from her, because I wrote something to her. But that kind of thing is wonderful to see on the Facebook, or I guess Twitter. I don't use Twitter, but there's a real positive thing about the social media. But then there are these awful things where people are putting on lies, terrible comments about other groups. And, if you read some of the things on social media, you can read one side writes about a protest and tells you all the positive things people were saying and doing and everything. And the other side shows, and I've seen this more than once, some pictures of protesters destroying things. And it's not the same protest, but they suggest it is. Mm-hmm. They use the same name of the city or the area. And it's sometimes I think it's almost impossible to tell what's true about those things. It's a shame that social media has become a way of getting the news. I sound like a broken record here, but I've been tempted to get off of Facebook because of that, but I get so many wonderful things that I can see that former students of mine are doing, mm-hmm. and I I'm so proud that they are doing things like that. Like this young woman, she probably saved that baby's life, or at least saved the baby from being ill for a while. And I have a number of former students who have wonderful practices, medical practices, dental practices. I have some, it's amazing to me, because I don't think of myself as being old sometimes, but I am old. And I have students who are retired captains from the fire department, students who have worked for the FBI and have a full career and are retired. And recently I found out a good friend of mine said he was going to see his father for his father's birthday. And I said, "That's nice. How old's your dad going to be?" And he said, "Oh, 75. And this is a friend who I consider a contemporary. Obviously, he's younger than I am. I have no idea how old he is, But that was a shock to me, because I'm going to be 79. And so, I said, "Gee, I was probably 4 years ahead of your father in school." And he got a great laugh about it. He said, "It doesn't seem possible that you and my father are both old." Since he said, "My father really acts old, and I don't think of you as being old," which was a nice compliment. But, those kind of things being shared on social media are wonderful. I have students I have two students who are great grandparents. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine that. and I'm able to hear about their life and hear about their accomplishments, and sometimes hear about some sad things in their life, but I think that's the wonderful part about it. The other part, people calling names and saying mean things and all of that is just awful. But what are you going to do? I know of a good friend of mine who lives in a town where he doesn't feel safe to, he feels safe all the time, except he doesn't feel like it would be safe enough to put up a poster about the man he's going to vote for in the upcoming election. Mm-hmm. Because he thinks he and his family would be in danger in that town. Mm-hmm. That's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
You know, you should be able to vote for whoever you want and, you know, put up a sign for whoever you want. But some places you can't.
That's right. Yeah.
And that was the political roundup. And
So that was a story in itself, several stories in itself.
Yeah.
And according to the time that you gave me earlier, when I belatedly turned on my
We're at timer. 55 or 56 minutes in.
Yeah, that's what I have.
So
there's not time for another Stash Zelkowski story unless it's 90 seconds long.
You want to hear a 90-second story?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this will be slightly off topic. Not a whole lot, but here we go. Because you said nuts and berries. Well, this is a story from France. And there's this young man who every morning would walk down the street in his town where he lived, and he would stand across the street from the bakery. And he would just stand there and enjoy the aromas and the smells just for a few minutes, and then he would go on his way to work. Well, this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and the baker started to notice, you know, and he, after a while, the baker would come out and say, "Hey, you, come buy something. You're stealing from me." And the young man just laughed because he thought, the guy was kind of grouchy, but he wasn't stealing. Anyway, in this town, the baker went to the police and accused the young man of stealing. And so it was a small place. They took him to court, and he appeared in front of the judge. And the judge said, "You're accused of stealing from the baker." And he said to the baker, "Tell me what he has stolen." And he said, the baker got and said, "He comes in every morning. He stands in front of my place. He stands across the street, but he smells the fine things from my bakery." And the judge just looked at him and said, "Okay, young man, stand up. Tell me about what you do tomorrow." He said, "Well, they make such nice things there, but I don't have a lot of money to spend on food like that. I live by myself. I have a poor job." And he said, "So I just stand there and smell. It makes me feel good. And I really like, stuff, because I know he makes wonderful things with all kind of fruits and stuff and nuts and stuff and breads and everything." And he said, "So I don't think I was doing anything wrong." And the judge, who turned out to be a very wise person, said to the baker, "Mr. Baker, you stand up. Young man, you stand up." And he said, "Young man, do you have any coins in your pocket?" And he said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Not many." But he said, "Okay, take out the coins in your hand and shake them." And so he did. And the judge said to the baker, "Do you hear that?" And the baker said, "Yes." He said, "Good. He is smelling the odors from your wonderful baking, and now you heard the jingle of his coins." Case closed. Isn't that wonderful?
And with that, we're going to close the Enlightened Storytelling Hour.
Have you ever heard that?
Not told that way. There was no judge in the version I heard, but it's a great story.
I like that story.
It's a quintessential Stash story.
Yeah.
Okay. We are closing out the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, encouraging all of our listeners to tell all of our stories, share our stories, and We're hoping that you'll join us next week at 12 noon on Monday. Coming up next.
More jazz. It's a Divas week here, Jazz Divas. And
All right.
Yeah, so
All right.
A long list of them.
Good. Thank you, John Casey.